Pilots have seen things most people will only dream of. Your host, Jeff Lively, has had his fair share of time in the sky and has plenty of stories to tell. Here on Leaders of Aviation, we're speaking with others in the aviation industry to get their insight and inspiration. Together, we'll gain knowledge to pursue our goals. Life's a journey. Enjoy the flight.
Hey, what's going on, y'all? Thank you for joining us on another episode for the Leaders of Aviation podcast. Excited that you are with us today. And I have a very special guest with us joining us. And he is a CFII, an entrepreneur, and currently a first officer on a Learjet. Chris, welcome to today's episode.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely, man. I remember, when we had originally started to interact, I believe it was last year now, right before kind of the months leading up to Oshkosh last year. And then we finally had the opportunity to meet in person. And I'll never forget the generosity and the kindness that you showed my wife and I when we first came to Wisconsin for our first ever Oshkosh. You invited us out to eat and kind of showed us the ropes and taught us a little bit about the area. So just wanted to say thank you so much for that. It was greatly appreciated.
Hey, it's always fun to have other people, especially the out-of-towners, coming up and show them their first Oshkosh and, you know, get to show them and see that kind of wide-eyed look that they get when they see that many planes and that many aviators in one spot.
For sure, absolutely. How many Oshkoshes have you been to?
Oh, geez, probably at least half a dozen. Probably more than that, I lose count, though. So, quite a few.
Are you going to be there this year?
Depends on my flying schedule. Depends if I get that week off. But more than likely, I'll probably be in Lake Placid, New York, which is something we can touch on a little bit later.
Cool. Awesome. Absolutely. I will for sure get into that. So, Chris, let's take it back a little bit to how you got started in aviation and why you got started in aviation.
Oh, dear. Okay. So I think my first ever flying experience was a pretty long haul. We went from Minneapolis to Hawaii. So talk about that with, I believe I was 6 months old. So, you know, talking about a big long trip for your first flight was a big deal. But really the reason I got into aviation was, my grandfather had always had this desire, this passion to get into aviation. And he started at a later age. He started when he was in his early 60s. And unfortunately, he passed away from cancer before he could complete it. He had a series of heart attacks, too, which he wasn't able to solo. But he said, you know what, I want to do this. I want to try this. So he was kind of that inspiration. You know, that earliest general aviation memory I have is being about 6 or 7, standing in the dock at my parents' cabin in Sayre, Wisconsin, and watching him and his instructor fly over and just kind of thinking, you know what, Grandpa's up there, and it's kind of a cool thing. You know, fast forward about 2 years from then, he'd passed away from cancer. And the day that we actually buried him, we had the funeral and we buried him in the spring months. He passed away in February. And the day that we buried him, I did my very first Young Eagles flight. And the cool part is that 2 weeks ago, I met a cousin that I didn't know I had. And he is actually one of the part owners of the plane that I took my very first Young Eagles flight in. Way back then. So, and it was really cool. I got to go talk to the EAA chapter in Lake Elmo, Minnesota, a couple weeks ago and get to interact and see that plane again for the first time since I was 8 years old. It was pretty cool. So that's really how I got my start in aviation.
Wow. That's an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that. So, my grandfather was also a huge inspiration for me getting into aviation as well. And so I completely understand. What aircraft was that that he was flying?
So he was actually flying a tri-pacer, so Piper tri-pacer. And the cool part is I was actually able to track down that exact plane in Birchwood, Alaska, in 2019 while I was up there visiting a college buddy of mine at the Birchwood Airport there. And I actually got to see it for the first time since, you know, I saw it at the airport with him way back when I was about probably 7 years old was the last time I'd seen it. And it's got the same paint scheme. It's got the same fabric on there. It's a little bit in disarray because it is sitting out in the Alaska elements right now. But it was really cool to be able to see that for the first time ever. And I'd spent a decade and a half tracking that thing down. So to get to see her in person again was pretty cool experience.
Yeah, that is very cool. So your aviation essentially bug bit you at a very early age, especially with when you started flying with EAA. So how young were you when you started flying, I guess, consistently, and you know, up into leading to your flight training?
Well, let's see. I think flying consistently, I started when I was a junior in high school at the time. And you know, I was homeschooled for my last 2 years of high school, which gave me the opportunity to get my private pilot's license before I went to college. So I think I was about 16 when I started training, you know, soloed about year-ish later. Got my private literally a couple of weeks before I went to college, and then unfortunately took all of college off from flying because it's an expensive hobby, if you will. As a college student, you don't have a lot of expendable cash. So I did that. After I graduated from college, actually went different route, went into a journalism route. Actually started in teaching and then went journalism. That's what my degree's in. After that, I worked at a you know, PR firm. So after that was really when I started flying. And when I got laid off from that PR firm was when I really just decided, you know what? I don't want to work behind a desk. I want to just fly consistently. So I went and I knocked out all of my flight training in the course of a summer. So obviously I had my private, but I knocked out my instrument, I believe May 20th. Commercial single was June 20th. CFI was July 20th. And then August 19th was my CFII. So in the course of 4 months during COVID, mind you, we knocked out every single certificate rating that I have other than my commercial multi.
Goodness. Wow. That's a lot of flying in a short amount of time, huh?
Oh, it was intense, but through that opportunity, I got the experience to give back. So the Young Eagles program gave me my start. So I actually fly consistently with a student of mine. He's like a little brother. He's like an adopted little brother. He's 16 now. He was actually my first ever student. So he and I flew all around Wisconsin that summer, trying to build up that time for that commercial and then building that CFI experience for the, you know, check ride. Obviously not giving instruction yet, but giving, you know, I was a ground instructor, so I could give him ground instruction and then just flying with him and getting to see the world through a different set of eyes and such. And, you know, that kid still to this day flies with me, and he's pretty cool. And it's been just an opportunity to give back to him, but then other students as well, through that.
For sure. And so during COVID, did you have, like, was the aircraft availability like more so open than, you know, regular times, you know, quote unquote, whatever regular means, but, you know, did you have a pretty open availability to the aircraft during that?
Absolutely. And at the time I actually worked for the flight school that I was doing some training through. So we had access to aircraft, not different than everyone else, but just being with COVID, like you said, it was quieter. It was just, you know, you weren't competing as much for aircraft time.
For sure. Okay. Awesome. So when you started, or when should I say, when you got your flight instructor rating, you know, obviously you started working, I guess, for the flight school at that time that you were flying with?
Yeah. Yep. I did that for about, I don't know, maybe 2.5-3 months. And, you know, at that point decided, you know what, I kind of like the idea of business ownership. At this point, when I look back, I think I was entirely crazy, but you know, when you're 22, 23, you don't think that way. So you just jump in and you take that risk. So I did. I packed up everything that I owned and I moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and went ahead and started a school. I really wanted to offer accelerated courses because I was looking in the Midwest and there weren't really a lot of options for students to get accelerated programs the way that, you know, I did it kind of non-traditional. It was accelerated, but it was on my own. I really forced myself to do it. All my flight instructors were friends of mine, you know, at the flight school, and, you know, they really helped, but I really was the one that got my nose in that book and studied every single day. I think I ripped out all of my written exams in the course of like 3 weeks or 4 weeks. The November before I did all my training, I was like, you know what, we're done with this. You know, I've been dragging my feet on this. We're just going to get it done. And I really realized that good, effective training has to be consistent. And the way that we do consistent training is that accelerated course is not for everyone, but I figured out that, you know, it works for a lot of people and I really wanted to offer that. So that's why I started the flight school in Milwaukee.
That's awesome. So I love that you mentioned, you know, you've found a problem and more importantly, found a solution for it, right? That's all business is finding a problem that you can solve and providing value to others, and boom. So with the accelerated flight courses, you know, which ones were you, you know, which ratings and licenses were you offering?
I mean, we could do pretty much anything. The only one I really shied away from was private, because a lot of people, and I agree with this, is that private is the foundation blocks of all your flying. Your private pilot instructor or sport pilot instructor is the one that's going to influence you for the rest of your flying career. You're going to pick up things and those are going to stick with you. It's going to be hard to break them. So I didn't ever want to do accelerated private just because it's no fun and you're trying to learn too much. It's like drinking out of a fire hose. They all are, but especially private. So you really want to get that foundational skill. So we offered everything instrument up, but we really specialized in the CFI accelerated course. That was kind of our cornerstone piece for the flight school.
Okay. So yeah, let's talk a little bit too about that. So like a great point you bring up is, you know, private pilot, it for sure doesn't make sense to, you know, necessarily accelerate somebody's learning as through that stages. So in your opinion, you know, what is a good time frame for, you know, someone that is looking to get into aviation? You know, what is the expected time frame that they should expect to, you know, really dedicate to beginning to learn how to fly?
Well, you know, Jeff, in my experience, it really depends. If you're a driven, motivated person, you want to get into the industry and you really want to fly for a job. You know, there's two really avenues of people. It's the ones that want to go into this for a career, and then it's ones that want to go into this more for a hobby. There's no right or wrong answer. You know, it's great. If you want to be in for a hobby, that's awesome. If you want to be in for a career, that's awesome too. If you're really going to dig your nose in and you're going to just go for it, in the course of about a year to a year and a half, maybe 2 years, you can have all of your certificates and ratings to be ready to fly commercially. You know, you may need more hours, but you'll have all your certificates and ratings done. And really, if you're just looking at private though for a hobby, you know, you're looking at probably, depending on where you live, if you're in Wisconsin like we were, the weather kind of, you know, isn't great for part of the year. During the winter. So it might extend it a little bit, but I'd say, you know, 6 months to a year, if you really dedicate and you fly 2 to 3 times a week.
Okay. Yes. And, you know, with a private, did you ever have anyone that was interested in accelerated private courses?
We had a couple, and I really, really, really had to kind of guide them away from it, because I'd watched one of the flight schools that I'd worked with. I watched them try and do a private, and it's just too much information. It's too much overload. You know, when you go into your instrument, you can really start doing accelerated then, because you're learning new foundational skills, yes, but you're not trying to figure out how to fly the plane too. You know, because I always say that flying is not natural. You know, if it were natural, then we'd be born with wings, and we were not born with wings. So that's the big thing, is it's not natural. It takes a lot to get into that mindset and figure out how all these things work. You know, it's not like driving where, from the moment that you're taken home from the hospital, generally you're driving with your parents. So you watch them and you see how they drive and you see how they interact with other drivers on the road and stuff. Unless you're born in a flying family, you don't see that regularly. Yeah. You know, I've got some friends that were, but most of them aren't. And those of us that weren't raised in a flying family, you don't see it. So it takes a lot. So I really did say to those private students, and I say to anyone that asked me about it for private, just don't do that. Take the time. I know it's going to take longer, but go ahead and then just take the time to get those foundational skills, because those foundational skills are going to be the things that, if you get into trouble someday, are going to be the ones that will save your life.
Absolutely. Man, those are just all great points that you bring up too, especially with just private pilot. And then you mentioned with IFR, you know, you're just adding to the skills that you learned on private, and you know, that's essentially all it is as you continue going through your training too. But I want to back up a little bit too. So what online ground school or what type of training did you go through? Did you do 141, 61?
Well, I did 61. I did not want to do 141. There's nothing wrong with 141 training, but it just wasn't what worked for me. You've got to really, when you're going into pilot training, you really have to evaluate that. What works for you, what doesn't work for you. And part 61 worked for me. I like the unstructured or slightly less structured, you know, the ability to, you know, flow back. If I'm not getting a topic, we can go back. We're not stuck to a syllabus. And I really like that. And to be honest, most of my certificates and ratings was all self-study. For my written exams, I did sporties for the instrument ground school. And then test prep, I used the Shepherd Air. application, which is amazing. I tell all my students, just use that app. It will get you, you know, not just to pass your test. It's not just passing the test. Their explanations and everything that they have on there are awesome. They get you, I actually learned more from some of the, from that than from some of the online courses that I'd worked with. So those are kind of the big, the resources that I use. And then just a lot of self-study. So getting the FAA handbooks and getting in there, digging in and, you know, working with other pilots, you know, was really what I did. So I didn't necessarily use an entirely online ground school per se, but it was a lot of self-study and a lot of pulling materials from whatever I could get my hands on.
Got you. So primarily you used, I guess, 40s for the, you know, and quote unquote online ground training.
Platform. Yeah. Yep. For instrument for sure. And then commercial and the rest of them. I mean, I usually say that commercial is basically like an add-on to private. You're learning some more maneuvers. You're learning some more information, some more regulations. So yeah, I mean, I did use the sporties program for that too, but for the most part, it was mainly for the instrument.
Cool. Awesome. So now let's go back, fast forward a little bit now to when you were flight instructing. So how long were you flight instructing before you decided to dive into your own business?
Well, let's put it this way. I think I sent one student to Checkride. So that was it. It was, of course, I got my CFI in middle of July of 2020. And by, let's say I moved to Milwaukee in October. So all of about 2.5, almost 3 months went from, I'm just going to be a CFI instructing, you know, showing up when the boss tells me to get here, to why don't we take over the entire operation and we're going to manage all the stuff, even though I really don't have any idea what I'm doing, other than I know how to instruct, but I don't know how to run a business. I don't know any of that. So this is going to be a learning curve. You know, like I said, 23, I was crazy, but you know what? It's okay.
Right. So that's interesting. Did you know that you ever, like, did you ever realize you had that entrepreneurial bug, or was that just kind of a realization after you gained your ratings? You're like, hey, I could do this myself.
No, I'd had that before. I mean, I'd owned and operated a couple of businesses before that. I mean, I still operate a public relations firm. It's very small. It manages a USA Luge athlete. It's actually the 16-year-old that I mentioned earlier. So a lot of his publicity and stuff. So I'd owned a couple of businesses and still operate a couple on the side here and there. So that's been something that I've had since I was really little, actually. Probably since 10 was when I first started my first one.
Oh, very cool. What was that first idea, if you don't mind me?
Sure. No, that first one was, it was, again, finding a need. So, you know, I looked at that point, our family had a lot of VHS tapes from family vacations, and those take up a lot of room. So it was digitizing photos and putting them into like a DVD slideshow. So you wouldn't have to keep all these physical photos and boxes of VHS tapes, which kind of dates me a little bit too, but that's okay. You know, so kind of trying to do that. I mean, I owned what I called C's DVDs, and you know, our slogan was flatten your boxes of photos with C's DVDs. You know, I still have one of business cards for me. It's in my wallet. I carry it with me everywhere I go. You know, my parents still talk about that. So it was one of those, that was what the first entrepreneurial adventure was something like that. I think it was like 10 or 8 or something like that.
That's awesome. I love to hear that. And that's a consistent thing too with other people that, you know, I've interviewed on the show, as well as you know, other entrepreneurs that I've talked to, that bug always starts at an early age and takes fruition later on in life, which is the case in point here. So, you know, now let's fast forward again. So when you did start your own flight school, you know, what do you think was the biggest challenge when you started doing that?
To be honest, the biggest challenge was the fact that I had some good mentors, but no one really had experience doing what I did. No one I knew really ran a flight school. No one that I knew really was a full-time CFI. You know, no one had ever managed and run a fleet of airplanes, you know, which is in itself a nightmare at times, you know. So that was kind of the biggest hurdle, was trying to figure all this stuff out, you know, on my own. I had some really good people that were good in business, and some really good people that were good in instructing, but trying to find that middle ground, because I honestly have not been in an industry that's been this, I'll call it cutthroat, you know, where everyone's just trying to undercut each other and such as is the flight school game. You know, and I think that is honestly the biggest thing, is just, how do I figure this out? Where do I get information for this? Because there's no manual for how to start an accelerated flight school program.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I think the aviation industry is such a niche industry that, you know, people are, I don't want to say afraid, but maybe more so hesitant to share their ideas and concepts with others when, you know, in reality, I think you and I would agree on this, is that, you know, I've met with you and we've talked on multiple occasions, and I think we have an abundance mindset, and we, you know, I think we see more so, you know, providing value more than anything else, and you know, helping students out with is the ultimate goal, to get them to where they want to be.
Well, it is, because I knew owning a flight school, you're not going to make it big, you're not going to make it rich off that. My biggest goal was to make a living for myself, be able to live modestly, but mainly it's finding that value for that student, because I really was tired of flight schools that I'd heard about and heard horror stories from, that just, you know, go ahead and they steamroll their students, where they take their money and the student doesn't get the value for it. And I didn't ever want to be known as a flight school that did that. That was my biggest driving force, honestly, behind starting the flight school, was, yes, finding that niche and trying to fill that accelerated void. But the big thing was trying to bring some fun and bring some efficiency back to flight training. You know, there's a lot of flight schools that are out there that don't do that, but there's also a handful of them that do, and they really do turn a lot of students off from aviation. And I didn't want to have that be part of our reputation. That's why at Greg Aviation, we went ahead and we strove for excellence in everything we did. Even, you know, so you think about it. I mean, if a student busted a check ride, you know, which we only had one bust in my entire time of doing it, you know, we would go ahead and cover that, the aircraft rental for that retraining, you know, or, you know, if a student needed a little bit more training, you know, we're not going to nickel and dime them. I hated flight schools that nickel and dimed, you know, with that stuff. So that's really our business model. And any of the instructors that we had contracting with us, you know, I made it very clear that if I catch you nickel and diming, you're going to be out looking for a new job immediately. We don't stand for that. We're not going to charge for every single minute from hello to goodbye here with the student. That's just not going to happen.
That is awesome. I love that. Love that business model too, man. So with, you know, with providing the value that you were to your students, well, first let's get into, you mentioned managing aircraft, a fleet, you know, and that it could be stressful at times. How many aircraft were you managing?
Oh, we had three, if not four aircraft in the fleet at any time. They're all leasebacks, which is nice, because the owner of all of those was responsible for the, you know, paying for the maintenance. We had to schedule it, but we still had to deal with all the downtime and you know, such. And, you know, you have sometimes when, unfortunately, when you're busy flying, all of the 100-hour inspections come up at the same time somehow. Even if you try and stagger them, they always come up at the same time. Somehow, magically, those 100 hours just tick off. You know, so we had a week or two in there last summer during our busy season, obviously, that, you know, we had none of our paper fleet flying because we were waiting on inspections. You know, so that was kind of the biggest challenge, the biggest hurdle, if you will.
Sure.
For fleet ownership or fleet management. We didn't own it. It wasn't going to own. So.
Yeah. And when you said that, you had to schedule the maintenance. So, you know, the lease back, obviously the maintenance, or excuse me, the per hour rate was included with, you know, for any hiccups like that, not that it's a hiccup, you know, the inspections, I guess, are scheduled, but any other hiccups or maintenance issues that would pop up.
Yeah, I mean, you'll always have certain things. I mean, okay, a student has a hard landing and they blow one of the seals on the nose strut, you know, in which case, oh, that one's down for a little while till we can get parts in. You know, it's those things. And really, I'll be honest, from a business perspective, I am not a good business guy. I will be straightforward with people. You know, I'm not a good business manager. Because
everything that you've been saying has been just has been spot on.
Well, it is, except for when it comes to the financial side. Again, I wasn't in it to turn a profit, but when I jumped into this, I didn't do a lot of market research, and all of some of the overhead costs kind of caught up with us once in a while, you know, and just trying to calculate, because I wanted to provide the best value for the student. I didn't necessarily look when I started the flight school. I did later, but building that reserve fund. So, you know, adding a little bit onto each aircraft hourly rental, so you have that reserve fund. I didn't, you know, think that part out, because I'd never been in a business that required that, you know, this much equipment, you know, so you really had to plan ahead. Yeah. Which is one thing that, as a business guy, I wasn't real strong on. I'll be straightforward with anyone that asks.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that the fastest way to succeed is to fail.
Pretty much, which, yeah, I will.
No, you're right. No, it's absolutely right. that's a principle that a whole bunch of people I would say kind of miss in their own interpretations, because people are, you know, and this isn't anything, I'm not knocking you or anything, but like with like the failing application of that, right? More so or less, like right now we're talking about it and you learn from it. And now, you know, if you ever decide in the future to get back into that, you know, now, you know, hey, I need to do X, Y, Z because of ABC that happened.
Yeah. And I think you are right about the failing and everything. You know, if I had to do this again, I would try things a different million different ways, you know, but again, I don't know if they're going to work or not. They might not work at all, but you know what, if they do, great. And you know, it is that failure mindset, you know, you think about the number of times that the White Wright brothers failed before we actually got our first, you know, Wright flyer, you know, and they failed a lot. And if they hadn't failed and they would have just given up, I might not be here doing this today.
Absolutely. I love that analogy too, because they failed multiple times. And then finally in 1903, they decided to succeed. And here we are just a little over 100 years. And now we're, you know, freaking in space.
Well, and that is the cool part. And you know, if I look at my career, a lot of people would say, oh, you had a lot of failures because you didn't really make it big in public relations. You didn't really make it big as a flight school. And you know what? I don't care if we make it big or not. I don't want my name on a plaque. I don't want to be, if no one remembers my name at the end of, when I'm gone, I don't really care. If we have had some influence though, and we have created some safe aviators, and we have created, you know, that safety culture, and we've created the opportunity for especially young people to get into aviation, at least experience it, even if they don't do it for a career. That's what matters to me. It doesn't matter if we make it big, if we make $1 million, I don't care. But as long as we leave that legacy of helping and creating that positive light in aviation's industry, I'm good with that.
Love it. That's awesome. Awesome. Very, very cool. So when you were operating the flight school, you know, how many hours do you think you were flying per month?
Well, that depends. I spent a lot more time behind my desk than I would have liked. Usually until about 2 or 3 a.m. usually.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we'd fly 8 to 5 and then we'd go sit in the office and have to do, you know, the businessy stuff that I didn't like doing. And my accountant got very upset about, and when she's also your mother, then, you know, you tend to listen. we're very much a family business oriented family, but, anyways, you know, so we go, went and did that. I mean, we were probably I was probably flying 30, 40 hours a month.
Awesome. Wow. I mean, that adds up pretty quick, right?
it does. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot. I mean, if you were working at one of the busier flight schools, you'd get quite a bit more time, but I also had to balance the managing of the business side and everything else. And, you know, that was ultimately the reason that I got out of it, because I was just tired of dealing with the business, tired of dealing with emails at all hours of the night and calls. And, you know, as the owner of the flight school, if you've got a student that's late returning from across country, you get the call first, you know.
Yes.
You know, so it's just like, it's that nonstop kind of worry and fretting about, okay. And then trying to plan out maintenance and everything. It was just, that was the end of that. I was like, you know what? I loved what I did and I love instructing. I still instruct, but I was like, you know what? It's time for a little change here.
Awesome. Yeah. So let's get into that a little bit. So it kind of sounds like you were burning both ends of the candlestick and having a little bit of a burnout. So, you know, when did you decide to kind of, hey, you know, I'm not going to necessarily pursue this full time. Obviously you still instruct, but you know, what was that, the mindset that you had when you were like, all right, you know what, now's the time to kind of, let's see what my other options are.
Really, it came when we started to slow down last, you know, end of summer, because in Wisconsin, May, June, July and August are our big flying months, you know, and, you know, really I'd started to feel that burnout about late July, right around the time of Oshkosh, you know, walking around. And I just remember thinking, I'm too tired. I'm not even enjoying any of this air show because I'm thinking about, I'm worried about the company. I'm worried about this. I'm, you know, trying to figure out, oh, what accelerated students are coming in next year? What do I have to prep? What do I have to get ready? You know, and I was just like, you know what, this is silly to burn your, I love what I do, but I can't do this anymore. You know, so I really decided as our students started to slow down that I was just going to cap off our accelerated courses and say, you know, October 1st, you know, we're done. We're not accepting any more students after August, you know, scheduling wise. So October 1st, I think I finished up my last student on October 5th. And that was the end of that. I was just like, you know what, we're going to try something else. And during that time, you know, I'd been interviewing and working and trying to find something else.
Cool. So, yeah. So talk a little bit about that. You know, what were you researching and, you know, ultimately came upon?
Well, let's put it this way. There's not a lot of use for former flight school owners, if you will. Pilots, yes, but not former flight school owners. That's not usually a qualification listing there, you know, previously owned a flight school. You know, and I was like, I love instructing, but it got to the point where it's also a stressful job because you're, you know, trying to keep the students safe and yourself safe. So you get to go home at the end of the day. And I kind of wanted something that I could just go and fly again because I kind of missed the being able to actually fly. So as I'm looking around, and honestly, I didn't even get a callback from any of the jobs that I applied for. I think I applied for, I don't know, almost 24 of them. No callbacks, period, at all. The callback I got came from a friend of mine that actually flies for a company out of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And he was like, hey, you know, I ran into this guy from another company that does something similar to what they do. It's a charter. It's a 135 company. And why don't you give him a call? Why don't you, you know, kind of call him and stuff? So I called the number, and it took me, I don't know, 3 or 4 days of calling just to get through, you know, and I finally did get through. And I talked to who would become my boss, who's, you know, sitting in an office just down the way from me right now. You know, I got a call back, and he was like, well, you know, we don't really have anything in Minnesota, but if you're willing to go to South Carolina, we got something for you. So I said, you know what? It's warmer down there. I hate the snow. So let's do this. So lo and behold, about 3 weeks later, I was on my way down to South Carolina with everything that I owned in my Chevy Impala. And that's when the adventure started.
That is awesome. Such a cool story. And, you know, what were some of the other jobs that you were looking into? And then why did you apply? Well, first, yeah, what were some of the other jobs that you were looking into?
Oh, it's low time because I had less than 1,000 hours still. And you know, I was kind of looking at the fact of like pipeline patrol or skydiving pilot or, you know, maybe even some overnight cargo and stuff. And I looked at the quality of life and I'm like, you know what? It's a low time job. I get that. But at the same point, you kind of want to, I wanted something a little bit different, a little better quality of life. So that's why I ended up choosing the one that I did get a call back, which, I mean, I didn't really have much of a, I had a choice to accept or not, but I didn't really have any other options on the table, which was fine because the one that I chose, and if I had to do it again, even if I had a million other options, I would still go with this company I'm with now.
That is awesome. So yeah, talk a little bit about what it is that you do now, the aircraft that you fly, the missions that you do. It's pretty awesome.
So our primary business, and we are 135 operator, and we actually do organ recovery and transport for a organization. Well, we have two bases. We're in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and Charleston, South Carolina. And what we do is we go ahead and we pick up the doctor's team, and then we fly them out to wherever a organ donor is. And then that team goes and evaluates the organ. And if they like the organ, then they're going to remove that organ from the donor, and it's going to be loaded in a cooler, and it's going to go in the back of our aircraft, and it's going back to Charleston or wherever we started that trip, and it's going to go get given to someone and give a second chance of life. Based on that organ. So the type of flying we do is a lot of overnights, you know, because unfortunately that's generally the time when operating rooms and such have some more availability to handle the procedures that are going. But for the most part, it's a lot of fun, and it's a really cool experience. The first time that you load that cooler into the back of the plane and you realize that there's a heart or there's a lung or there's a kidney in there, you look at that and you go, oh my gosh, you know, someone's getting a second chance of life tonight or, you know, during the day, depending on the day, you know, and that's really cool. And I love the type of work that we do.
That is incredible. And it's so rewarding, you know, not only on top of, you know, flying, which is the dream that you've had for so many years, but now you also get to kind of do a full circle effect, and you're able to help others through that process, which you've always done. You know, when you're talking about being a flight school owner and wanting to provide the best value that you wanted, or that the students wanted, you know, and not nickel and diming them, you know, everything that you've done up until this point resulted in you, in my opinion, getting this position. And I think it's one of the coolest things, you know, that aviation has to offer. So, you know, congrats on landing that.
Oh, it's, thank you. It's amazing. And like I said, it's, one of those jobs that I didn't want a flying job, but I was just going to go and, you know, there's nothing wrong with airlines. There's nothing wrong with, you know, other charter service where you're flying people to and from the Bahamas and stuff. I mean, we may do that occasionally here and there, but for the most part, we do a lot of our business is organ recovery. And it's just, it's really cool. Because you see all these news stories on the TV about these donors and these recipients and stuff. When you get to be part of that, linking them together, it really lets you go home and have a sense of fulfillment at the end of the day that I've never had in any other job that I've ever worked at.
So you haven't mentioned what you fly at.
Okay. So I fly, yes. And that's the thing. So I do fly the Lear 60 Classic.
Awesome.
So we fly that. She is, from what I gather from some of our other captains and first officers that fly F-16s for the National Guard, this is the closest thing you get to a military jet in the civilian world. And it is true. This little thing will climb. It doesn't look like much in the ramp, but she climbs, and she climbs really fast. And, you know, it's kind of fun being able to catch up and sometimes pass the airliners, you know, that we were doing coming down to Florida last week.
That is awesome. That's so cool. So let's talk. Okay. So job position accepted. And then you're moving to South Carolina, but you also have to get typerated and have to go through training. So let's talk about that. You know, what was that process like?
Well, kind of scary for your first typerating, I'm not going to lie. So I moved to South Carolina in October, and I was down here doing administrative stuff October, November, and December, just because we were waiting on a opening at the company that we did our type school through. So that time finally came up in January. It was January 2nd. I flew from Milwaukee down to Atlanta, Georgia, and ended up the next morning in the seat, in the classroom, in Learjet 60 initial training. You know, and the first time that it really hit me that this was real, this was actually going to be my job, was looking in front of me, and they give you, at the company that we trained at, which is Plate Safety, what they do is they give you a name placard, and it says, you know, LJ-60 pilot initial type. You know, and looking at that, you're going, okay, this is real. This is actually happening. You know, I'm actually going to be flying this jet in a couple of weeks. And that was cool. The type school, I'm not going to lie, your first type is a lot of work, and it's a lot of drinking out of the fire hose. You can't really be prepared for it either. I've had some other pilots and mentors kind of say, oh, this is how it works, whatever, you know, and that's great, except for until you have to do it yourself, you have no idea how it's going to work. So I'll be honest, you're absorbing everything. In about 3 weeks, you learn as much as you can about that plane and as much as you can about flying it and every system on board that thing, you know, and it's a lot to take in, but it is so rewarding at the end.
How was that training? You know, what, you know, walk us through a typical day at Flight Safety.
Typical day, your first week is all ground school. So you're spending about 8 hours a day in the classroom. We actually lucked out when we were there. They actually had some extra sim time. So what we were able to do, our instructor was actually able to take us down to the simulator. And what we had learned about, let's say, the power plant. So, you know, we go down to the simulator and kind of play with starting an engine and such like that. So we got that hands-on experience of, here's what we learned in the classroom, the textbook. Here's how it actually works in the plane, you know, that same day. And that was really, really awesome. You know, a lot of students don't get that because they're so backed up, but we happen to have a lull in, you know, training that week. So we were able to get into the sim quite a bit more than, you know, we were even supposed to, which was pretty cool. So then after that, we actually had a bit of a hiccup. We had a COVID scare with my training partner and I, you know, we were exposed to COVID at that point. So we were kind of put on ice for a couple of days just to make sure that we weren't going to get sick and, you know, anything like that. So we went back into the sim. And, you know, it was really, it's something when you fly the sim the first time and you actually take off, it's an experience. It's the only time I've ever gotten airsick ever flying, and we didn't even leave the ground. So
wow,
it's something. And you talk to a lot of pilots though, a lot of them do get sick in the simulators. You know, that was the first time of, okay, I'm airsick. I don't know how this is going to work. And then you work through it, but it added one of those challenges that I didn't anticipate, you know, on it. But when you go from flying a Cherokee 140 that maybe cruises at 110 if you're lucky with a tailwind, to flying something that cruises at in the Machs, you know, at Mach, you know, we usually do 0.795 or so, you know, it's a little different. I'm not going to lie. And then you go back and, you know, after I'd flown the jet for a couple months, I went back to Milwaukee and flew with one of my students, and you're flying a Piper Dakota 235. And, you know, I used to think that plane was so fast to stay ahead of on an instrument approach. And I'm sitting there with a student going, okay, how long is this going to take? Are we ever going to make it to the final approach fix? You know, it's interesting how much your perspective changes very quickly. You know,
Go ahead.
No, yeah. And, you know, you from flying something that small and you get handed this jet and you're like, oh my gosh, this is a lot happening at one time. So,
right. That's really interesting, though, that you get airsick in the simulator. Was it just new motions or like it was a faster speed? I mean, you're on the ground, but I know you're simulating because those are real simulators, you know, not little red bird simulators at any given flight school, but these are full motion, you know, fully capable simulators. So, you know, what do you think was the cause behind getting sick?
You know, ultimately it goes back to the fact of what we teach our instrument students, you know, so when you're doing your instrument rating, you really learn to trust your instruments and ignore your body, right? Because your body really has no idea what's going on. Because it doesn't, without those visual cues. When you're stuck in a simulator, while you're looking through, so they have plexiglass around the, for the windscreen, you know, instead of real glass, they have plexiglass, and you're looking at these monitors that are kind of grainy. You know, it's a simulator, it's good, but it's still a simulator projector screen. You know, so you're looking at that, and then the simulator, especially on takeoff, that was when I used to get the most sick, was you push the throttles up, and the simulator kind of rocks back a little bit. It's that motion of where your eyes are not telling you, are not agreeing with what your body's feeling and experiencing. I think that's really where it comes from, is not having those real visual cues, because your body's like, mentally, I know I'm on the ground, but I'm moving and I'm flying, sort of. So it's kind of trying to trick your brain into, it's fine, it's all good, but you know, you have to get that mindset down.
Wow. Okay. So that's very interesting. That's the first time I've ever heard of, I mean, it makes sense though, you know, with pilots getting sick in the simulator. So, and, you know, an instrument when first, so you know, go back to being when you're a first time instrument student and you're learning everything, right? In terms of your scan, holds, approaches, everything. And now fast forward to the Learjet, you know, and something that you learn in instrument is stay ahead of the airplane. How hard is it to learn how to stay ahead of a Learjet?
Well, it takes a while to get that down. You know, my first couple of approaches in the simulator, you know, I'm used to having miles and miles of, you know, time to go ahead and figure out, you know, let's load the approach, let's get everything briefed and stuff. Here it's like, by the time you say the word brief, you're at the final approach fix if you don't plan it out. You know, I'm used to planning like 5, maybe 10 miles out. Now you got to do, you know, 50, 100 miles out. You know, it's a little different. And if you don't stay ahead, then you're really going to get yourself in trouble. Wow. You know, so it's a challenge, but once you get the hang of it, you kind of stick with it. And unfortunately, flying with my poor student in Milwaukee in February, you know, I'm like, okay, let's prep for the approach. And he's like, we're 50 miles out. I'm like, oh yeah, sorry. That's right. We don't have to descend, you know, thousands of feet and, you know, try and set this up in, you know, 0.2 seconds.
Right. You can see the runway and still set everything up.
Oh, absolutely. You can, you know, so that's fine. You know, so it's my poor student and I'm making call outs that I'm used to in the jet. Cause I'm like confused at this moment in time as we're on the approach. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just going to shut up. You do your thing. I'm just going to be quiet over here. I'm just here to safety pilot for you.
So, you know, that's cool that you bring that up too. So with learning the Learjet and then also flight instructing, has that at all, in your opinion, sharpened your skills as a flight instructor?
I'd like to say it has. However, when I go into these little tiny Cessna 172s and Pipers that don't have autopilot, it kind of makes me miss the jet because the jet does a lot of the flying.
Right.
I'm not going to lie. You know, you get up and, you know, it's autopilot on and let's go ahead. You know, there is a saying that, you know, flying jets is like 9 minutes of excitement for hours and hours of boredom. You know, watching that jet. And obviously there's a lot for us to do. We're trying to monitor systems. It's not that we're just sitting up there, but you know, it's not as much as trying to manage this, you know, Cherokee 6 or whatever, you know, and it's turbulent and stuff. That's not really a thing. So you do, I'm not going to lie. I will admit that I've become a little bit lazy, if you will, in regards to, I want my autopilot. This is too much work.
Oh, that's funny. That's hilarious. What would you think going through your Learjet training was the biggest takeaway from it?
the biggest thing is being humble, because you go from, as a flight instructor, sometimes you get into that mindset of, because you're working with people who know a lot less than you about the aircraft, right? You know, especially when you're working with primary and instrument students, you know, so you kind of get in that mode of, okay, so I'll call it almost a know-it-all attitude. You don't treat the student like that, but you're kind of like, okay, I got this. Anything that the student can get this plane into, I can pretty much get it out of, you know, with these flight trainers. Whereas when you go into the Lear, you kind of go in with that mindset of, okay, I got this. I've studied. I know how this works. You don't have any idea how this works. You know, you're going from flying approaches at 90 to maybe 70 miles an hour to flying them at 200 miles an hour. Wow. There's a little difference, you know, so just maintaining that humble aspect and just realizing that you've now become the student, and now just kind of remembering how your students feel. And to be honest, that's the biggest takeaway I get when I go back to instruct, is remembering what it's like to be a student. Because not 2 months ago, I was doing this in the simulator. And I remember what it's like when you get frustrated and when you're like, it just won't work. I can't get the plane to do what I need it to do. You know, and that's the biggest takeaway I've gotten from my Learjet training, transitioning back to instructing, is you don't know everything. Always be willing to learn. And, you know, I finally take my advice, because I tell my students that all the time.
So awesome. So awesome. And, you know, love your attitude towards this. And, you know, you have a very caring nature that I think some at least parts of the industry are missing, as we kind of, you know, touched on earlier as well. So with, you know, being, you know, the full-time Learjet pilot, you know, what would be a typical flight mission day per se? Because I know right now, before we hopped on, you said you're kind of on a layover, you know, for maintenance reasons. But what would be a typical day for Chris Gregg?
Well, I'll tell you what, we don't have one of those. I'll tell you that right off the bat, because what we do is we're on call. You know, so we are, when the phone rings, you know, we're ready to go. Cause we're, you know, on crew rest, and then we get ready, you know, we go on duty, and then when we get the call, it's time to go. You know, we could get a call and we may leave from Charleston and go to Huntsville, Alabama, like my first mission, or we may get that call and we may be dispatched up to start out of Baltimore or DC or Boston, or we've been in Detroit, Milwaukee. You know, you don't know where you're going to go until that phone rings. And that's probably the best part about it, is there is no normal day. Normal days for me are boring. And I, to be honest, that's the reason I left office work. you know, I like not knowing where I'm going to be flying that day. It's just kind of, it's just more fun, you know? So it's one of those things. But generally, you know, we'll fly, because we actually store a jet outside of Charleston at Walterboro. It's a low country regional airport. So it's about a 8.5 minute flight, barely enough time to get up to altitude and then right back down. You know, it's about 50 miles away. So we cross that, we go and commute to Charleston generally, that's where you pick up our doctor team. And then from there we're getting dispatched. And then depending on the organ we're picking up that day, it could be 4, 5, 6, 7 hours on the ground. We don't know. Usually hearts are first, you know, those are the first things out of the body. So, you know, those are quicker missions generally. But if you got an abdominal, so a liver, a kidney, something like that, you may be waiting a while, you know. And the cool part is, usually when you show up, there's a couple other jets there that are there for other organs and other pieces of the body too. So it's kind of cool, because you get to know all these, the pilot community within the medevac world for organ recovery. And you get to talk to them, and you see them at this airport, and then a couple weeks later you see them again, and you're kind of like, oh, hey, how's it going and everything. So it's really cool. It's really cool knowing that we all support the same mission. Of bringing life to people that are on that wait list, on that organ donation or recipient wait list. And it's really cool knowing that you get to do that. So like I said, your typical day, we may be doing an overnight, we may be doing a day flight. We don't know. We may be leaving at 9 p.m., not getting home till 4 or 5 a.m. That's normal for us.
So a niche within a niche is what I'm hearing.
Yes, very much. Very much. It's not, we have normal, but we also don't have normal. So it's very confusing.
Awesome. So, you know, let's say you just mentioned you could have day missions, you could have night missions. So let's say you complete a mission, you know, what does that crew rest look like? Like, is there a regulated time to, like, hey, for the next 8-10 hours, you can't fly, you can't do, like, what does that look like after you go on a mission?
Yep. So basically when we land, basically from about a half hour after landing, we start our crew rest time. So we have to have 10 hours uninterrupted rest at that point. before we are legal to fly again. So basically, the general rule of thumb is every 24 hours, you have to have 10 hours in there that are uninterrupted crew rest, where they can't call, they cannot request that we're in the airport. You know, we legally cannot go anywhere during that period of time as a 135 operator. So we do have those regulated times. And generally, I mean, as far as normal goes too, we may go 3, 4, 5 days without getting a call for a mission, or we may go almost every, 18 hours we're on a different mission or, you know, whatever. As long as we always have that crew rest, and our boss is always really good. He always usually gives us more than the 10 hours just because he knows that, especially with an overnight, it's hard on your body, especially if you do 2 or 3 in a row, they get really old real quick. So he gives us usually 11, if not 12 hours of crew rest though, which is really nice.
That's awesome. So that's, you mentioned 3 to 4 days off. So, let's say, like, how do you schedule that time? Do you just kind of always ready for that phone call? And as soon as you get it, you drop everything and go to the airport with your go bag?
For the most part, usually, I'll be honest with you. I moved from Milwaukee. So the fact of having a warm beach nearby is something I've always wanted. So I spend more time on that beach than I do in my condo. That go bag and that pilot shirt is always in the back of the car ready to go. If my phone rings, generally we have 4 to 6 hours of call out time. Generally, not always, our minimum is 2 hours of call out time, but generally it's 4 to 6. So we got plenty of time. We'll know. So I can go grocery shopping, get to the beach, get a nice suntan, and then hop in the plane and head to where we're going, Huntsville, Alabama, and such like that. I tell my friends and family, they're like, well, can we schedule this? Can we come down for this? Yeah, but I may not be here. I may not be here. And that's fine. You want to come down? Great. But, they also talk about, well, what if you want to go to a concert? Okay, you go to a concert. If you get a call, you leave the concert. It's just how it works. Yeah.
Well, you're really a doctor of the skies.
Sure, let's put it that way. Yes, and especially when you're talking to those doctors and stuff, you kind of look at them and you wonder, how can you take this heart out and make it beat in another body? And you talk to them a little bit and I had one of them tell me, if you put me in the cockpit, I'd be thinking the same thing. So, it's just that specialization. I'm like, good, I'll stick up here. You stick back there. I can't handle blood anyways. So
there you go. That's awesome. Well, Chris,
that's the cool.
For sure. Hey, thanks for joining us again today. If people want to connect with you and follow you and maybe ask questions about, being a on-call medical Learjet pilot, where are some good places for them to connect with you?
Absolutely. I've got Instagram. That's usually a pretty good place to connect as long as you request. And then Facebook's another one. I check those fairly regularly. Try to share a little bit about our missions that we can share. Obviously we protect our patients, recipients, donors, all that. I do share a lot on there. So if you want to follow, it's First Officer Chris on there, and such. So go ahead and just follow me on Instagram or request. You can also send me an email, chris@gregaviation.com. Those are kind of the big things. And if I could, one little tidbit that I do want to share to kind of wrap this up is, if you're a pilot out there and find a way to give back to your community. I talked a little bit about the 16-year-old that's been flying with me since he was 14, right? And he goes on a lot of flights and, whatever. And someday I'm really hoping to fly with him on the same flight deck. But giving back to him and giving back to other young people is really important. And that's why I really support the mission of the EAA Young Eagles program. Go out and give flights. If you are a pilot, if you have access to a plane, even if you have to rent one, go give back. Because I wish that I had someone when I was a teenager that would really have, taken alongside me. And I actually did have someone that did mentor me through from the time I was in sixth grade all the way through now. He's a retired Delta pilot now, but he's been awesome. He's been instrumental. But I wish that I would have had more opportunities to get out to an airport and get out and see planes and touch planes and be around planes than I really had. So that's why I try and give back to as many of these tweens and teenagers as I can. Because I really want to have them have the same opportunities to explore this. And who knows, you might be flying one of the future aviators, one of the future pilots of Air Force One or Medevac or whatever. You never know where that dream's going to take off, because I'm pretty sure the guy that flew me when I was 8 years old did not know that I was going to eventually end up flying organs around. with that. So it's just one of those cool things. So just give back, find a way to give back if you can.
Love that. Love that wrap up to you, man. Thanks again for your time today. And, you know, really enjoyed talking with you, and thanks for sharing your journey and your story up until now. You know, we'll for sure have to do an update here and maybe a year or two another podcast episode, and, you know, see what Chris Craig is up to and how everything's been going.
Absolutely. I would love that. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man.
Thank you for tuning into the Leaders of Aviation podcast. Make sure to share this with someone you know that can benefit from this content. Remember to support this show by rating, reviewing, and subscribing.